So, so last time we covered, we spent some more time on out of order execution and how register renaming works. Then once the instructions are renamed, dispatch looks for instructions that have all of their operands ready. And so we track which physical registers are currently available and which ones are waiting for the instruction that's producing that physical register value to complete. We talked about branch prediction and branch target buffers and how for the direction of a conditional branch, we can remember the direction that previous branches took. We sort of skimmed past that, and I'm going to come back to that since it's important for the upcoming material on side channels. So here's the out-of-order processor that we're talking about. And so the branch direction prediction may be happening, may be divided up into multiple pieces, but conceptually, for purposes of the upcoming exercise, you can think of it as happening here. Some logistics. The pipeline assignment is due tonight, and then the out-of-order homework is due next Tuesday before the first section, so 10:45 a.m. No extensions, because we want to be able to discuss the assignment in the exam review if there are questions. So, I mean, if you're sick, something happens, let us know, but the normal kind of late window for 90% credit won't be there for the out of order execution homework. So let's just briefly recap branch prediction. So we talked about the notion of a static prediction. And some simple static predictions would be always predict the branch is taken or always predict that the branch is not taken. And that's gonna have a fairly high misprediction rate, and mispredictions in an out of order processor are very costly. And so a slightly better static prediction would be to assume that loops are the most common scenario where a backwards branch would actually be taken. So you're looping back to the top of the branch. And for if statements, you might predict that in the common case, they'll be not taken. So forward branches are not taken. Looping back to an earlier point in the code is probably a loop. You could predict that as taken. Better, but what we really want to do is kind of remember some dynamic behavior. And people will write loops, loop structures that have a backward branch that actually might not be taken for various data-dependent reasons. And they might have if statements that actually skip the then clause and jump to the else clause quite commonly. And so we can actually maintain a table. Conceptually, you could have a table for every branch that remembers what direction that branch took the last time you saw it. Now, we can't have a table that's arbitrarily large, so what we'll probably do is have some hash function on the address, or more realistically, we'll just have something like our cache access, where for the size of a cache block in the instruction cache, we will ignore those offset bits, and then we'll take the next group of bits to index into whatever our table size is. And so we can therefore get an approximation of, for every branch, whether, or for every cache line, whether we're going to be executing sequentially, not taken, or whether we're going to be jumping to another address and whether we need to look in the branch target buffer. And every time we see a branch and predict it, we'll then look at what the branch does, remember that outcome, and update this table. So here in this example, we'll use bits 4 to 7, which is the second hex digit. So for this branch, we might look in index 2 of our branch history buffer and see that the last time this branch was visited, it was taken. And so we send that prediction to the fetch stage, and that's combined. That means that the fetch stage will use the value from the branch target buffer to update the program counter rather than just incrementing the program counter. And then later, when that branch commits, we'll take the actual outcome and update this table. So here's a simple code sequence that gives an example of this. This assembly code corresponds to this C code here. And so right now, the table starts off with that branch being predicted not taken, but we're actually starting the loop, so we're going to be looping back up to the top. So once that first branch reaches the commit stage, we'll see that we did actually loop up to the top of the branch, jump up to the top of the loop. And so the outcome will be taken. And so we'll update the table like this. And then on the next trip through, we'll see that the prediction was taken based on the last visit to this branch. And this loop iterates 4 times. So we will be going back up to the top of the loop again. So the outcome will match the prediction, so we don't have to make any change. And we'll keep going until we fall out the bottom of the loop because we've completed our 4 iterations. And on the last visit to this branch, because now we're not jumping back to the top of the loop, our prediction will be taken, but the actual outcome will be not taken because we're falling out of the loop. And so with this simple one bit of history, we'll have 2 mispredictions per loop, one when we start the loop and one when we end the loop. Because this not taken now will be remembered the next time we come back to this loop. We can do a little better. We can have more bits rather than just 1 bit so that it's a saturating counter. Let me just skip ahead here a bit. There's been quite a bit of research on better branch predictors. They've become very elaborate. My PhD research 26 years ago was on how to build better branch predictors. It's still an active area of research. They just keep getting better and more sophisticated. They've incorporated some concepts from very simple perceptron AI algorithms. But the basic idea is you're trying to accumulate a lot more history and context of what the program is doing to get a better prediction of what it's going to do next. So you might maintain more history for this branch. You might also maintain some history of what other branches that have recently been visited did in terms of taken, not taken behavior, because that gives you some clue about the current scenario that you're in for this branch, and so on and so forth. So just to wrap up the out of order material, it's a really powerful algorithm. And it was actually only invented in the 1960s, but only started to be implemented in the mid-90s, because that was the first time that we could actually implement something that sophisticated on a single microprocessor chip. When it was invented in the 60s by IBM, they were building this with discrete logic components on giant circuit boards. And while that was great for an IBM supercomputer, that wasn't really something that was affordable at scale. But with the Intel Pentium Pro, it started to become actually practical. It has limitations, and so a lot of the subsequent research was on trying to overcome these limitations. So often, you'll have a lot of instructions in flight in the issue queue, but they're all waiting for some instruction to complete and produce a value that all these downstream instructions are waiting for. So you have a lot of instructions waiting to run, but they can't actually run, and you're not actually getting much utilization of the compute units. One way to overcome this is to have the compiler do a better job of spreading out the consumers of values that are being produced. Can't always do that because some code sequences just have this kind of funnel effect where a lot of values, a lot of instructions depend on a single prior instruction. Another way is to extend the window of instructions that you can see by making the instruction queues bigger and having the reorder buffer be bigger. That requires a lot more hardware and is generally fairly costly to implement. But these structures have steadily been getting better. Intel Skylake, which was, 5 years ago, Charles? Yeah. Had a 224 entry reorder buffer and 168 physical registers. Last year's Zen 5 from AMD went up to a 448 entry reorder buffer. Something that's roughly equivalent to 114 instruction issue queue. It's divided up into pieces. It has a 240 entry integer register file, 384 entry floating point register file, and a 16K entry L1 branch target buffer. That's just the L1, there's an L2. And then I don't know the size, but a very large pattern history buffer for predicting taken, not taken. So the net effect of all of this is that as you put more instructions into a loop, it doesn't necessarily actually make the program take longer. So when we compare these two loops, this is an example we saw early in the class, the extra add instruction here doesn't actually change the execution time because it can run independently of the other instructions, and so you can very nicely get more throughput in the out-of-order instruction architecture for this more complicated loop body with good branch prediction. Okay, so branch prediction is important in understanding how side channel attacks work, and so that's going to be the focus of today's lecture. So a side channel is basically a way of deducing information that's not through direct register based computation or inspecting memory that the program itself has access to. It's by detecting behavior that leaks information from one application to another application, and of course this can be a privacy or security violation. So here's a simple example. Let's say we want to check a password or passphrase using the following algorithm. We just compare the input passphrase to the reference passphrase character by character until we have a mismatch, and then we bail out. So we then, of course, what happens is that the number of iterations tells you the number of matching characters in your input or test passphrase, which, of course, leaks information about the passphrase. So an attacker could enter a variety of different strings into their password checking interface, have a separate mechanism for the timing of the password checking, and learn something about how many characters in their input passphrase matched, and work their way toward actually cracking the passphrase. So it might look something like this, where we try a bunch of passphrases, and you see here that DAAA takes a little longer. That probably means you got another character. You got that first character right, so the checker had to go another character into the checking compared to all the ones where the first character was wrong. Then let's say you try now with D as the starting character, all the possible second characters. You get the idea. So timing is one way to infer information. Power can be another. If you have a way to instrument the power of a computer system, you might be able to learn that certain patterns have different power signatures. And so there's been some published work. There's actually been quite a bit of published work showing how you can, if you have physical access to a device, infer values by monitoring the power that's being drawn by the processor. And there's also been work showing that by monitoring radio frequency patterns that are emanating from the execution, you can also infer patterns. So we'll focus on timing for the discussion here. Just be aware that there are many mechanisms for information to leak. And we call these side channels because they're not the main channel for interaction. They're not the legitimate channel. They're something that kind of leaks out of the side of your information, your legitimate information flow. So there's been a lot of focus in particular on how these side channels can create vulnerabilities in cryptographic algorithms that maybe are algorithmically secure, but the implementation has a side channel vulnerability that leaks information that makes them less secure. So for example, lots of asymmetric cryptography uses big integer math, where you're multiplying, you know, huge factors together, like 500 plus bit numbers. But your hardware only supports, let's say, 64-bit arithmetic. So let's say we want to have a 128-bit product, but your hardware only gives you 64-bit products, then you can do the multiplication by breaking it into parts using a formula like this. And in the interest of time, I won't elaborate on the formula, but you can extend this idea to arbitrarily large numbers, like might be used in your crypto algorithm. And then the number of these multiply steps would depend on the size of the numbers. So if you have a 500-bit factor, but the actual value is a small number, then you don't have to go through all of those steps because a lot of these terms would be zero. And from that, you can rule out large parts of the potential space of these factors and make it much easier by brute force to figure out the rest of the bits because you've drastically narrowed down the search space. And this is bad if this lets you deduce somebody's private key. And this actually happened. So early versions of OpenSSL, which was one implementation for the TLS in browsers that we looked at earlier a few lectures ago, actually allowed attackers to do pretty much exactly this. And this was shown in some work about 20 years ago by these guys. Dan Bonet, incidentally, was his office was next door to mine in grad school. And so what they showed is that in essence, with a lot of measurements and accounting for kind of the noise of the measurements, with sufficient observations, you could actually infer what the values were using some kind of measurement like this. Just another example, yeah. Pardon? We'll talk about that a little more in a few slides, but the basic idea is you want all of your implementations to have the same timing regardless of the actual value. So for example, if you're multiplying numbers using big integer arithmetic, you would want to be sure you do the same number of steps even if some of the terms are zero. And so if you make things deterministic independent of the input value, if the timing is deterministic independent of the input value, then you can prevent one particular form of leakage. Here's another form of side channel. It seems kind of trivial, but like it's just illustrating the many, 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 many ways that side channels can happen. So web browsers will run code from untrusted web pages. And you probably don't want some random site that you visit to be able to figure out your history of which web pages you visited. So, you know, maybe you're a Democrat or a Republican and you don't want some random website to be able to label you as being more interested in links about one or the other party. Well, it happens that your browser will actually use the history to mark the color of links, right? So a link that you visited recently will have a different color. So now you go to visit a website and it can run a script that you don't know is running that will check the color of all of the links that you've that are being displayed. And by reading that color, it can then know whether you visited that link or not. And it could actually make, perhaps in a super tiny font that you wouldn't even notice, a whole list of links that it wants to know your history, your visit history, and then inspect the colors. Probably something you don't want to happen. So how might you prevent this? You can have the browser, you can modify the browser so that when a script queries the color, it doesn't actually get the correct answer. So then you're not leaking the color of the links. It might still display on the screen the way you want, but it won't leak that information to anything, any kind of script that's running. Or you might have some other limitations on the styling for visited links. Another form of leakage that could happen if some malicious script is running in your browser is that it could time a loop that writes into a big array, and variation in the timing of that loop might tell you something about other things running on the machine. And if it can get you to enter your password and do some timing, and there's a side channel that it can exploit, it might be able to learn some parts of your password and then with brute force guess the rest. There was a paper a few years ago that showed that the browser, we'll get to the key example later, but the browser could learn what other processes were running on the machine because different processes create distinct signatures that will show up in this timing mechanism that I was just describing. So side channels are observing indirectly what the machine is doing. And we talked about a few examples of the kind of side channels that might exist and how they can leak information that is private or sensitive. So we're going to look at a couple of examples leading up to the Spectre attack, which was really profound because it fundamentally changed the way that we have to design processors with speculation. And out-of-order processors have lots of speculation, not just branch prediction. But it turns out that anything that's timing independent in that out-of-order processor design can actually potentially leak information unless you redesign it in a way that avoids that. And so why are we asking you to learn about this? Well, we think it's important that students who are graduating from our program understand these kinds of vulnerability, because it actually informs how you need to write software so that the software is secure. And understanding how the vulnerabilities happen at the hardware level is a lot more effective at leading to an educated programmer than just telling you, do this, don't do this, because other side channels can occur. And being able to understand the literature and or even the popular press that's describing a new vulnerability will hopefully make you better computer scientists in whatever career you pursue. And especially if you're writing browsers or operating systems or other software systems that hold sensitive information, this is really important. So what we're going to do now is focus on how you can use a side channel and timing observations to infer which location in a cache some other victim process accessed. So if the attacker can learn what cache line a victim process touched, then you might be able to learn a data value. So here's an example. Sorry about the type text here. I must have clicked something when I was in Adobe. But you see here the basic idea that if you set up an array and then later go back and time your accesses to the array, and one of these accesses is slower than the rest, you know that in between the time that you set up the array and went through the array the first time, and then the second time when you go through and time the accesses, that array 192, that cache line, must have gotten evicted by something else. So here's some pseudocode. In this pseudocode, we're going to access all of an array that fills up part of the cache or all of the cache. And then this is kind of a proxy right now in our pseudocode for what your victim process is doing. So let's say that you access a pointer and you write a value at that address. And then you time accessing the array. The cache line that this access touched will have been, will come into the cache and evict the corresponding position in the cache where the array was occupied. So let's say now we discover that array 128 is slower to access. Then we know that the address of this pointer is touching the same place in the cache as array of 128. So there's a conflict in the cache. For now, let's just assume it's a direct mapped cache. And let's assume that our array fills up the cache so that when we do this access all of array, we're completely filling the cache with our array. And then that means that this access has to kick some part of our array out of the cache. So this timing will detect which part of the array, which cache line size piece of the array got evicted, and that lets us learn something about this address. We only learn some bits. We only learn the cache index bits. We don't learn the tag bits. We don't learn the offset bits, but we know that the array of 128 and other address share the same cache index, right? So it's designing an actual effective attack is a little more complicated than this because caches use physical, not virtual addresses. And we need to know about physical addresses to compare index bits, but we can get around that. And our timing might affect the cache, but we can compare the timing with and without the access of interest to get around this. I briefly mentioned that caches actually do some prefetching. So when you're walking through a linear array, the processor will detect that pattern and prefetch values that are not currently in the cache to try to avoid the latency penalty of cache misses. And that can obviously interfere with this attempt to detect which access was slow, because if your array accesses in the timing part are actually leading to prefetching, then it will corrupt that timing that we wanted. But there are ways to arrange the accesses to avoid triggering the prefetcher, and we can use, well, we'll just leave it at that, because we want to get to the main concept, and then some of the details of how you actually implement this on a modern processor can be left for a more advanced course if you're interested. Just knowing the concept of what actually the vulnerability is important. Let's look at a little more sophisticated example. Can we learn the value of mystery here? So it's kind of like the example I showed you before. We're going to allocate some aligned physical memory so that we know that our array starts at the beginning of the cache, just to make the arithmetic easier. And we're going to load that array into the cache to make sure we fill up the cache with the array. And then this is a proxy for what the victim process is doing. We want to learn the mystery value. Right now, we'll just put it in our own code to illustrate the capability. And so we've primed the cache. Now we have this mystery access, or this access that is conditioned on this mystery value. And then we time access to the array. Now suppose pointer here, suppose we somehow know this address. And maybe we know this address in our victim process because we've looked at some kernel code. We know how kernel code is laid out in memory. And so we can guess the address of interest. And suppose we know that the cache for the particular hardware we're running on is a direct mapped 32K cache with 64 byte blocks. What array index should we check? So, we know that we have 9 index bits. 2 to the 15th divided by 2 to the 6th is 2 to the 9th. So we have 2 to the 9th sets. Our set, it's a direct map cache. So we have 2 to the 9th cache blocks. And that means we have 9 index bits. And so here is our offset. And then here is our index. And so to get index 6, we don't really have a way to get insight into the offset. We want the array index to remembering that the array starts at the beginning of the cache. Sorry, I should have said. So we won't worry about the offset, and we want the index to be 6. So that means we need our, this is a char array, by the way. We need our array index to be this value, which corresponds in hex to 180. Does everybody see how we got this array index? Because this is a really important conceptual step.
You can check any array index with IDX equals 110, right?
Yes. Because it'll all be the same cache block. So I want to make sure that people see here that if we know the pointer address, if we know the address of interest, then we need to check the cache entry that has the same index. And so we need to compose the index to our array, so when I say index to the array, obviously that's a different index than the index to the cache. We need to compose our array index so that the bits that correspond to our cache index, or that dictate what our cache index will be, will match what we know that the index of our known address is. Now, in the more realistic attack, we won't know what the address is of interest necessarily, but this is a step to get there. We have cache lines, and we're not worried about the offset, we're only worried about the index. So array 0 will be here. And array 1 will be here, and array 2 will be here, and so on. And so if we have 64-byte blocks, array 0 through 64 will fill up the first cache line, the zeroth cache line, actually. And we need to get to the sixth cache line. And so that's how we assemble this. Any questions? This will detect when the pointer is accessed. And you might think that that will let you know that mystery was true. Because we, in the way the code is written, we only access the pointer here when mystery is true. However, in any modern processor, even a small embedded processor, there's going to be some branch prediction going on. So it's possible that this branch was predicted so that, as if mystery is true, but that that was actually an incorrect prediction. And so we will need a way to deal with that as well. So let's make this a little more sophisticated. Suppose we have another array, and we now want to detect what index we're accessing. So mystery is now the index into other array. And we want to figure out what position is being accessed. That might let us learn something more practically useful. So we do our timing, and we discover that in our test array, that the interesting index that has the timing anomaly is at I equals 0x800. So can we deduce what mystery is? Well, at I equals 0x800, here's our offset, and here's our index. And so we need, if we know the starting address of the array, again, maybe we know this by having inspected some kernel code or some other open source code, and we know how it gets laid out, then we need the following to be true. We know this. We know this. And we know this. So we solve for this. We won't learn anything about the offset bits, but we will learn this. So let me just check my notes and see if there was something else I wanted to say here. So what we will know is that the other array, base address, plus the mystery offset in that array has the same cache index, or if it's a set associative cache, the same set as array, which starts at cache line zero, plus our index, which is 0x180, or ends up being cache index 0x20. So we know that the mystery is at this address. We just don't know where in that cache line it is. So let's do another exercise. So let's say we have this pointer, and our cache is a two-way. So now we're moving from direct map to set associative, 32K cache. We don't know what the replacement is. Ends up not being so important for this. What array indexes should we check? So here I want you to actually see if you can work through this, because this is a good test of whether you're following along so far. You're gonna have a lab tomorrow, and I can guarantee you this will show up on the quiz and some future materials, so you definitely wanna make sure that you understand how these things work. And let me just give you the binary to make this a little easier. So this is, we don't care about the first few characters. So it's 1000, 1000, 0001, 0000. So this is your offset. And we don't have a way to learn anything about the timing of different different bytes or different words within a single cache block. We can only see kind of at a cache block granularity how the timing varies. So that is six decimal or hex. It's six. So what are the actual values that we need, the array indexes that we need to check? So if we don't worry about the fact that it could be in two different cache lines within the same set, we're going to want to look in array of 0x6 times block size. Does everybody see why that is? Any questions?
Can check just be that, and then you mess up the tag a little.
Right. I'll get to that in a sec, but yes. So this will give us one possible location, right? So we want to move in steps of cache block sizes, so 64 bytes in this case, because we can only sort of check array indexes on a cache block granularity. We could check any value within that cache block. It doesn't have to be the zeroth byte of that cache block. It could be the first byte or the 15th byte. That doesn't matter. It's all going to be the same. So we want to move in steps, as we do our timing, we want to move in steps of cache block chunks. So we want to basically test every index. And in this case, we know that the index of interest is index 6. So we want to check array index 6, but we also have to worry about the fact that this is a set associative cache. So if this were a direct mapped cache, looking at array index 6 would be good enough, because there's only one possible place in the cache that can correspond to index 6. But in a two-way set associative cache, there are two cache blocks that have the same index, right? Remember back to associativity? And so we also have to check other multiples of this. This would be good enough for direct mapped. However, what we really want to check is array of 0x6 times block size plus k times block size times the set count, which is 2 in this example. So if you understand this part here, then getting from here to here is just testing multiple locations in the array that will have the same index that are offset by the size of the cache. That's why they have the same index. So you're checking array index, so let's see, 6 times 64 is, can't do that in my head, should have thought to do that before we, before I presented the slide. So that would be array index 384, and then we would do array index 384 plus 32K, and that would be enough to, assuming the replacement policy isn't funky, to ensure that we're checking both ways in this set that has the index 0x6. And if we were worried about the replacement policy, we could test a couple more that are offset by 32K. So maybe for archival purposes, I should say here that this is for set associative. Any questions so far? Yes. Yes, actually, because it's, let's see, Plus 16K should be enough, yes, because we only have 8 bits of index.9. Thank you for catching that. So here's the general pattern. We're going to, in our attack, we're going to set up an aligned array so that it's easy to reason about locations in a cache. We're going to sweep through the array and make sure that the array is filling up the cache. And then this is actually, this is a proxy for the victim. So this is actually the array access in the victim code that we want to check. But to show the example, we're showing it in line in our code. Then we're going to go through and sweep through the array a second time and check if it's slow to access. And so what this does is it lets us learn some bits of mystery that correspond to the index bits. That's the part we can discover. And then that makes it easier to brute force guess other bits of mystery. So here's a simpler example. Suppose that we know that array of 0x6 times block size is slow to access. What do we know about mystery? We know that mystery is equal to 0x6 plus k times set count. Because we know that, and the thing that I guess I should highlight here is I've changed the pattern here. We've changed the pattern to factor out the block size. Right? So from the previous example, we've factored out the block size. So if we sort of factor it and write it as our mystery bits that we can actually learn about times block size, so the position within the block we can't find out because they'll all have the same timing, then what we learn is this. So if this is the number of sets in your processor, in your cache. So this paradigm is kind of the basis of prime and probe. So the prime is filling the cache with values. Then something happens that uses the cache. This is in the attack. This is hopefully the victim. It's accessing the cache. Then we probe and access the values again and see which one is slow. And there are other mechanisms that have the same basic idea. Like instead you arrange to flush the cache and then you reload. It ends up being the same thing. You learn which cache index was accessed. And this was developed in the context of an attack on AES. Now I said, hopefully this thing that happens that touches the cache is the victim. You have to do this in some kind of many number of iterations so that you kind of average out over the random behavior that can be happening and you can start to learn what the actual value was, right? So if you just do this once, you might get noise. If you do this many times, you might actually learn something useful. Yeah.
Sorry, on the previous slide, is K cache size?
K. On the
very bottom line, what is K?
K is the number of sets that we need to account for. So if this is direct mapped, you don't need that second term. Oh, I'm sorry, yes. So you don't know that these bits of mystery. Right. Thank you for catching that.
And then K times step count is basically just like a modifier for the tag.
Yeah, that's a way to think about it. Let me add this clarification here.
That's good.
So there was a paper back in 2004 that showed how an AES implementation that used lookup tables, which was a way that it was being implemented for efficiency back then, could be broken using this approach. So by detecting the index into the lookup table, you learned something about the key and the data being encrypted. And then to actually turn this into a full-fledged attack, they had to test this with a lot of data being encrypted and average out the measurements and do this over a large number of measurements. And so here's the kind of data that they acquired. This is a figure from the paper. And you see here that there's a pattern based on the sets being accessed that leaks information about what the key was. So if you do this over many different kinds of data, the thing that will be common is the key. And if you leak some bits of the key, then you can brute force guess the rest. So the idea of all of these encryption algorithms is that the keys are large enough that you can't just brute force try decryption by trying every possible key. But if you take a large key space and narrow it down to a small key space, computers are fast enough to actually crack that. So revisiting an earlier example, how do we deal with the case that we can't actually know whether mystery is true or false because we don't know what the branch prediction, what the branch predictor is doing. So here's an example where we are showing in an out-of-order processor some code that corresponds to what we saw earlier where load mystery from memory and put it in RAX. Then we do our comparison and we jump if the comparison is zero to skip and don't do the pointer access. But if that branch is mispredicted and we go into the then clause of the branch, we will actually access the pointer. And so the branch only commits out here, but in the meantime, because of the misprediction, we fetch this code and it starts to flow through the pipeline. And you see here that the write to the memory can actually start to flow through the pipeline and potentially touch the cache. So we might want to avoid this problem, or we might want to actually use it to our advantage to see past a branch that should prevent illegal accesses. So suppose we have some code that looks something like this and guards the access to the pointer. What can we do to make this more or less likely to happen? So suppose in particular that we're trying to find the other array mystery bits here, and that's inside this condition that should evaluate to false so that this access should never happen. If we can train the branch predictor so that it predicts that this branch is taken and we actually, the branch predictor causes us to execute this code or to start to execute it, even though it's not committed, the instructions corresponding to this access will be fetched. And depending on how quickly the branch misprediction is resolved, this cache access may happen before the branch misprediction commits and gets squashed. And then when branch mispredictions get squashed, we don't undo the cache accesses that they made. So if we loaded something into the cache on a mispredicted path, we're gonna leave it in the cache, because otherwise cleaning up branch mispredictions would be extremely expensive. We'd have to keep track for every branch of all the cache locations that were accessed on that mispredicted path, which could be an arbitrarily long set of cache accesses if it takes a long time for the branch to get to the commit stage. And then we'd, as part of the misprediction cleanup, not only would we have to flush the pipeline, we'd have to somehow have this data structure in the hardware that kept this list for every branch of the cache locations that got touched on the mispredicted path, and then go to every corresponding line in the cache and flush those cache entries that it touched. And we wouldn't necessarily know which way it touched, so we would have to flush all the lines in each of those ways. And this would not only take a long time to clean up, and branch mispredictions are pretty common. I mean, even if your prediction accuracy is 99%, that means one out of every 100 branch instructions are getting mispredicted. So that's a lot of cleanup overhead. Plus, you're throwing out a lot of cache lines that in the common case were perfectly harmless, and you're going to impact the performance of the code that is running on your computer. And so you're just running regular code, there's no attack in progress, and you'd see significant slowdowns as a result. The upshot being, if we can train the branch predictor to predict this to be true, we can potentially get this cache access that isn't supposed to happen, and then we can learn the information that's being leaked. So for example, this can let us see past not only branches that guard some piece of code so that the guarded code should only access under special circumstances, we can even potentially use it to see past seg faults, because seg faults do not happen seg faults are not, in the typical implementation of out-of-order processors, seg faults are not cleaned up until the seg faulting memory access commits. So when a load or store has an exception, that gets marked in the reorder buffer, and then you deal with it when that code gets to commit. But if the illegal access happened on a mispredicted path, you don't want to start doing exception handling for code that never should have run. So that's why we wait until the commit stage to handle the exceptions. But as a result, we might be on a mispredicted path, or we might have a seg fault that's on a correct path. And then after the seg fault, we touch some memory, and that affects the state of the cache. And then we can do a probe and find out what got touched. And if the probing can happen fast enough that, So the probe will see the impact of that cache change, even though there is eventually a seg fault that flushes those instructions. Because remember, this prime and probe is in our attacker, and this code here conceptually is running in our victim. And even if the seg fault happens because of some memory that we're touching, let's say memory in the kernel that we're not supposed to access, so we have an access that seg faults, we'll still be able to come back from that seg fault and resume execution and probe and see the change to the cache. So we only need access to this to start before the seg fault is detected, and not necessarily commit. So this led to the first of these vulnerabilities that was discovered, called Meltdown, which was a step toward the Spectre attack. Before I talk about that, let me just comment here. I hope that people appreciate here how learning about this timing side channel mechanism is starting to bring together a lot of concepts from the course. And we'll see how this can be used to read values from kernel memory, for example. So we're touching on kernel memory, exceptions, branch prediction, pipeline structure, out-of-order pipelines. Pretty much most of the material from this course comes together in understanding how these side channel attacks work. All right, so you can try to read a value from kernel memory. So I've got an attacker, and what I'm actually attacking is the kernel. So I can read memory that's marked as not accessible in the page table. And if I do it inside a branch that will end up being, because it's false, if I can make this predicted true, then this access will happen. I'll touch the memory. There will be some impact on the cache, but then when the branch is resolved, we'll clean up. And it'll be like this didn't happen. Our code can continue to run, but we'll have changed the state of the cache. And if we are accessing some array here that is where we want to observe this value. So we read a value from a location we're not supposed to access, and then we use that value as an index into an array, like we've seen before. And the value is actually at some multiple of cache block size or maybe a page size. We can actually extract this value from the kernel. So we want the branch to be something false so that when we make the branch predictor predict true and execute this code, it gets cleaned up and doesn't crash our program due to an illegal access. Then we access the value that we're not supposed to access, and that raises a seg fault, but the seg fault doesn't get resolved yet because it might be on a mispredicted path, and it actually is. And then we access some location in memory. We access some location in this array that's at an offset based on the value that we just extracted. And that modifies the cache in a way that our probe can detect. And then it turns out that because this caused a seg fault, this code doesn't actually commit, but the cache change still happened. And so that was the meltdown attack that was first published in this paper. And here's what it actually looks like in assembly code. We'll come back to this and revisit it on Thursday. But some of the tricks that they had to employ to make this work were to space out the accesses in page chunks, because it turns out that this avoids triggering the prefetcher. And it also ensures that we're touching separate cache sets. And we might have to repeat the accesses here because we're trying to get the kernel address, and if we're accessing something that's not yet available, the Intel implementation will fill in a temporary value of zero. And to make this work, they used a variation of the prime and probe technique called flush and reload, which is conceptually the same. And the details are a little bit hairy and more than we can cover in 3 minutes. So this is probably a good stopping place. And let me just use the last couple of minutes to see if people have questions. So you have enough to be able to do the lab tomorrow. Your final homework is the out-of-order homework that is due on Tuesday. And I'll stop there. Any other questions? All right, so on Thursday, we'll look at the meltdown attack in detail and then move on to the more general Spectre attack, which is more powerful and much harder to prevent than meltdown, which was due to basically a fairly simple optimization that Intel implemented that created a vulnerability that was easy to close. Spectre is much harder. And that will then wrap up the material that we cover in this semester, and next Tuesday we'll use for final exam review. So think about what topics for next Tuesday you'd like us to cover, to review, and let us know. All right, thanks everyone.